KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. Last week, President Trump made a big decision on climate change. He pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord. What about the more personal decisions we make around a changing climate, like whether or not to bring children into this world? That's what KUOW's Ashley Ahern looked into in our new podcast, Terrestrial. The podcast explores the choices we make in a world we have changed. Welcome, Ashley.
Thanks, Bill.
The latest episode of Terrestrial is about whether to have kids in a time of climate change. And why did you decide to focus on that question?
Well, I mean, we like to start with the easiest question.
Sure,
first, right?
Sure. So. Low-hanging fruit. Let's just knock this one out.
Ease into this whole thing. Yeah, no, it's personal, right? We're trying to make this podcast personal. And I feel like coverage of the environment, it's time to just look listeners in the eye and say, here's the agency we have. Here are the choices we can all make. And I'm 33. I'm thinking about having kids. Been married for a couple years. Like, don't know what we're going to do. My husband and I both think about the environment a lot, and I won't say it's our top factor in our decision, as it isn't for most people, I will say, but it is one of them. And so I wanted to do an episode that just says, okay, let's look at it from this angle, this universal question. Let's just take it from the environment angle, because that's what we do on Terrestrial.
I love the question, and the answers differ. Who did you talk to about this?
So many people. I gathered tape on this episode for more than a year. We talked to young couples who are having kids, who have had their first kid, couples who are choosing not to have kids. I also wanted to speak to people who already have kids and are wondering what the world ahead looks like for their children.
Sure.
And so we talked to a climate scientist, a renowned climate scientist at Stanford, and I asked him, 20 years from now, when my kid's 20, when my hypothetical child is 40, like, what does the planet look like for them? And so got some real science to work in. And then we also just went straight to, the controversial and talked to a guy who started a group called the Voluntary Human Extinction Movement,
mm-hmm.
under the belief that basically humans are bad for the environment and the planet. And he calls us a super predator, and says that it's time for us to excuse ourselves voluntarily by not having children.
Yes.
A lot of interesting perspectives.
I hung on the entire episode, Ashley. I played a little bit of it on our show recently. It was your conversation with a couple who has decided to have kids, mm-hmm. even though they know there are climate risks. And the husband said he didn't want to make a family planning decision out of fear. In response, we got this phone call from Daniel in Seattle.
I do make my family planning decisions based, at least in some degree, on the state of the environment. And one of your other callers said, I never make a decision that's good based on fear. Well, I don't want to injure any more of the planet if I can avoid it. And I don't want to cause more hardship for more people as well. And that means, you know, as things are heating up and as things are speeding up on this planet, that my small part is by slowing down our reproduction rate.
Okay, Daniel thinks protecting people and the planet, that's a fine reason not to have kids. What other responses have you gotten so far?
It's been phenomenal. So we started a Facebook group that people can join. Just type in Terrestrial and ask to join. And people there just had a really candid, open conversation about all of the spectrum of choices that we all make in this one kind of universal decision. I'll read you one. Nathan wrote, this was the exact conversation I had with my now fiance. And I have to tell you, Bill, like, there's so many people who, when I talk about this episode, their faces just light up and they're like, oh my God, I was just thinking about this the other day, or my husband and I have been talking about this.
I did.
He said, it was the most difficult discussion we ever had. I was taken aback by how assumed the idea of having children was by her entire family. And when it came right down to it, their desire to have kids really felt like cultural momentum more than anything personal. It actually almost caused our separation, it being the last big conversation we needed to have before committing to an engagement.
Mm.
So, and then Nathan said, I asked him on the Facebook group, I was like, well, so what did you do? I'm on the edge of my seat. And he said, we decided to build an adopted family.
Yeah, adoption. That's a very good point. If you don't want to bring new children into a changing climate, why not adoption?
A lot of people, you know, spoke up on the group and said, yep, I've adopted. I'm, you know, very happy with their decision, like, love their children. And also looked at it as a potentially better a better option. But some other interesting comments about that were, well, if you adopt a child from a developing country, the carbon footprint or the environmental footprint of that child over the course of his or her life in that country will be considerably lower than a child born in the U.S. So there is an environmental component even to where you adopt your children from, which doesn't make it, you know, again, a right or wrong as to where you get your adopted child. It's just another factor that I find really interesting for discussion.
Oh, yes. What, a few other responses that interested you?
I'll read one from Erica. She wrote on the Facebook group, "I think the most important issue here is the issue of choice. Many people don't even realize that not having children is actually a legitimate option. Justify your choices however you need to, but in the end, they are your choices to make and no one else's." That really spoke to me because right around the time that I got married, I thought I was going to have kids. We were like doing the baby thing. And then I kind of like stopped for a minute and was like, hold the phone. Like, how do I really feel about this as opposed to just assuming that that was the next step? You know, mm-hmm. you get married, you buy the house, whatever, and you do the kid thing. So it was good to hear from her. And then another really interesting response we got from Catherine, she tweeted, "Every generation has this question. Mine, Vietnam. My brothers, nukes. My parents, World War II. Their parents, the Depression."
Good point.
Yeah. So I think that climate change does represent an existential threat to our species in the same way that people probably were thinking about nuclear war during the Cold War. And so I don't really have a strong answer to that except to say, well, if it is the existential threat of your generation, then you should probably be thinking about it. So that's what we're doing.
Talking with Ashley Ahern from the KUOW podcast Terrestrial. Now, I came down sort of where Chris did. Chris tweeted about this. To propose that someone not have kids solely because of climate change is to assume that human ingenuity can go no further. The more people on Earth, the more minds we'll have to create and implement solutions. Again, I don't know what's right and wrong, but I related to that as sort of an optimistic way to look at how a new life affects the Earth. Ashley, whatever your, you know, people's opinions about this, I was interested in how angry some people got that you even asked. What's that about?
I kind of joke that I like went out into a lightning storm with a lightning rod.
Yeah.
Like I mean, first of all, I'm a woman and I had the nerve to talk about procreation and choice. Second of all, I talked about climate change, which when you're on Twitter, the climate skeptics come out in full force. And I would posit probably didn't even listen to the episode, which if you listen, I don't come down on either way or tell people what to do. I just explore kind of the personal decision-making process.
Mm-hmm.
But the vitriol, and I will say from older white men directed to me on Twitter saying, you know, you probably, the gene pool would be better off without you. And, you know, at least there will be less liberals if you don't procreate, to which I responded, fewer liberals, fewer, please.
I'm sure they appreciated the grammar correction.
Yeah.
That really lowered the temperature.
But they say don't feed the trolls, so I haven't been. But It's been interesting to see just how visceral the response is.
Last question then, Ashley. You said you made this episode because you're trying to figure this out for yourself. And what have you decided?
Well, I'm one of four. My sister just had her second. I'm really excited right now about being a brand new or second time auntie. I've got a couple more years. And frankly, adoption had never really crossed my radar as a really serious potential option. And I have to say now it definitely is for a lot of different reasons alongside the environmental component.
Ashley Ahern, host of the new KUOW podcast, Terrestrial. And we are, of course, tweeting out a link to that new episode right now. And if you want to weigh in on what it means to have kids or not in a time of climate change, that conversation's still going on, right?
At the
Terrestrial.
At the Facebook Terrestrial. Just type in Terrestrial on Facebook. It pops right up and join the group.
Ashley Ahern, thanks for visiting.
Thank you, Bill.
It's KUOW's The Record, made possible by you, the listener. This is The Record on listener-supported KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. It's been called the hardest rock climb in the world, the Dawn Wall of El Capitan in Yosemite National Park, more than half a mile straight up. 2 years ago, Tommy Caldwell became the first person to free climb that wall. He did it without any climbing equipment, just his arms and legs and a rope around his waist for when, not if, but for when he falls.
It has this incredible and sometimes unnerving feeling of exposure. And you're living in this vertical world. You can't walk. You're always either grasping onto these tiny little nubbins on the rock or you're hanging from your ropes. It's windy. It's sometimes cold. It's a very hostile environment.
And that is not the most hostile environment that Tommy's been in. Far from it. For his 21st birthday, he went climbing in Kyrgyzstan, where he and his climbing partners were captured by rebels.
We were climbing in this area that was 50 miles from the nearest road. It was very remote. We thought it would be a safe place to go climbing. But in the year of 2000, it became kind of an opium trade trail. And essentially this rebel group, Al-Qaeda affiliated, this was pre-9/11, so nobody in the U.S. really had heard the word Al-Qaeda at this point, or not very few people had. They moved over these mountain passes from one side. The Kyrgyz military came up from the other side, and a war broke out. We got captured by these rebels, held captive for 6 days.
Why were they holding you captive?
we're valuable. You know, we're Americans. They could have ransomed us. We were sort of being used as human shields. We're in the middle of this war. We were being shot at. They were being shot at. And the shooting was less aggressive because they didn't want to, you know, shoot the American captives.
Right.
And yeah, so we were just very useful in a situation like that.
So what was your captivity like with them? What was going on? Were they moving you around? How were they treating you?
Yeah, so the war broke out and we had to very quickly abandon everything. We had no food, neither did our captors. We had very little water. We would just come across it occasionally. During daylight hours, we would bury ourselves in little holes in the ground, cover ourselves up with brush, hide very quietly. And then at night, we would sneak around from one location to the next.
What was that like?
It was scary in a sort of way that still seems surreal to me at this point. It was one of these experiences that's so just different than anything else I had experienced, so painful that honestly I'm still trying to wrap my head around it.
Painful, physically painful.
Yeah.
Besides scary.
Yeah, we were starving. We all the four members of our expedition each lost nearly 20 pounds each. We were on the verge of hypothermia in the high mountains, and we thought we could be killed at any moment.
When did you figure out you had to do something more?
So for these 6 days, the other two male members of the expedition were very much like, we need to take matters into our own hands. Our best chance for surviving this is to escape, and that is going to mean overpowering our captors.
You're talking in English, and they're not understanding you or hearing you?
Yeah, right. We would just change the inflection in our voice. We would talk very frankly about killing these people right in front of them, but we would do it in a way that they didn't understand what we were saying.
Okay.
So I was in the other camp, and so was my girlfriend who was along on the trip with me, Beth Rodden. We were kind of split in two different camps. I thought that we should just wait it out.
When you say the other camp, you mean the other mindset of like, what's the best or least worst plan?
Yeah, right. Yeah, two different mindsets, exactly. And so I was under the impression that we should wait it out. But as the situation got increasingly dire, I started to realize that we just couldn't wait it out. On our sixth night, we were high on this mountainside with just one remaining captor. It seemed like a storm was rolling in. We were already on the verge of hypothermia. We hadn't eaten in 6 days. And it was painfully obvious to me that this was going to be our chance to escape. Like, we were climbers. We were on a mountainside. We were very comfortable in this environment. Our captor was not. And so the act of, you know, the physical act of going up and actually pulling this guy over the edge was actually not that hard. It was just sort of the mental battle that went into it ahead of time. Like, should we do this? And I waited till the last possible moment. We were just about to top out the mountainside and the opportunity would have been over in just, you know, in just seconds. So I waited to the very last moment and then I ended up taking matters into my own hands, which has, you know, sort of haunted me in ways ever since. And part of the reason that I wrote this book was to sort of grapple with that and understand what it meant.
I gotta know, what was it like to throw this guy over a mountain?
Yeah, so I had been waiting for the other two guys to do it because they wanted to. I didn't.
Yeah.
But it's hard to come to that place where you're willing to do it. It's just for whatever reason, it's just really hard to make it happen in the end. And so I realized they weren't going to do it at some point. I looked at my girlfriend and I was like, are you okay if I do this? Because she was adamantly against it too until this last moment when she realized this was our only chance. And in that moment, she didn't say anything, which to me was her blessing. And so I just kind of ran across this ledge in the middle of the night. It was dark under, you know, a relatively full moon. And I grabbed his gun strap and I just pulled him over backwards and watched him fall out of sight. It was incredibly surreal. For a moment, I was just kind of numb, I guess. And then I scrambled to the top of the mountain to where there was a flatter space. And I sat down and I just broke down. I mean, I write very vividly of this moment. I'd kind of blocked it out of my memory for a lot of years. But when I sat down to write this book, these were the first words I put in there. And I talk about sort of the surreal nature of the moment and how, you know, all the emotions came crashing down on me in an instant. And that's a very intense scene.
Before we leave that mountain, I take it you don't know what happened to your captor. You saw him disappear.
We do, actually. Oh? So we figured we had killed him. A reporter contacted us about 3 months later when we were back home and told us that he had been found in prison in Kyrgyzstan and that he actually lived. And at first, I couldn't believe it. None of us could. We're like, this is a ploy. I don't know why this reporter is saying these things. But we found out that it was true. And the two other members of the expedition actually went to Kyrgyzstan, ended up getting permission to talk to him in prison. Dateline did a big piece on the thing. There's a whole nother story behind that.
Wow. I'm talking to Tommy Caldwell, a climber who was captured by Al-Qaeda in 2000, and then 15 years later, he'd become the first person to free climb the Dawn Wall of El Capitan in Yosemite National Park. I sure remember when that happened.
Yeah, everybody does. That was a big media event for sure, surprisingly.
You said that your experience in Kyrgyzstan is part of the reason you decided to try that El Capitan climb?
Yeah. What I was saying is this quest to figure out the limits of human capability. I mean, I've been constantly identifying things in this world of rock climbing, which is what I do, that will push me as hard as I can imagine. And I've for the last 20 years, I've just come up with one after another and after another. I've gone to Patagonia, I've gone all over the world, but my real venue has been El Capitan, and I've climbed a lot of routes up there, but I eventually got to the place where I was looking for something bigger, something that would push me harder, something that would answer those questions. And so that's what the Dawn Wall became, and it's turned into a 7-year quest.
Help us understand this a little more. It sounds like you're saying you in some way wanted to get back to some part of the feeling you had pushing a guy off a cliff and saving your life. I mean, that sounds kind of crazy.
Yeah, it's not the fear. It's not the fact that I killed somebody. It's more that coming to life when you physically think that you should be completely used up. It's that limits of human capability. It's really more the physical side of that. I think, if you understand that if you change your idea of what you're capable of, if you move that bar, 10 steps out, life becomes a lot less scary. And so it's a very empowering thing.
Okay. You're capable of a lot more than you knew, that kind of feeling you talked about?
Yeah, Kyrgyzstan taught me that. And then, the Dawn Wall was supposed to be an exploration of that, I would say.
But here's what worries me a little. We've just met, but do you feel addicted to that kind of danger or exhaustion?
Yeah.
Because that's worrisome.
I mean, my book dives very deeply into this idea of risk and how far should we push it. I'm a father now. I have a lot of people that I need to be alive for. And so I talk a lot about going on one climbing trip after another and doing progressively more dangerous things. And yeah, so at times I have definitely felt addicted to it. For me, the Dawn Wall, though, I became so obsessed by that one because to me it represented this perfect balance. It was this huge, big goal. It was incredibly emotionally appealing. It was challenging, but I was relatively certain I was going to live through it. Like, it's not actually that dangerous. There's no big avalanches that can come and wipe you off the mountain. It's a clean rock face. It feels exciting when you're up there, but you're tied into ropes, and if you fall a long ways, they catch you. And so,
it wasn't that big a deal after all.
The challenge was a big deal, but the danger wasn't. And I think
it looked like the kind of face only Spider-Man is. That's what I remember about. Like, how's any human being?
Yeah.
I know you have something to catch you, but how's that even possible to do that?
Right. So the intriguing part of the climb is not only taking an environment that looks impossible and looks scary and making it manageable, but it's also the athletic quest. It's trying to pick this goal that is above you and then rise your abilities to match that.
But how is that drive to push yourself to your own limits, how is that a sustainable way to live?
I think that you can challenge yourself always. I mean, writing this book for me was an understanding that I maybe shouldn't push the risk side, and I'm not going to always be able to push the physical side, but you could just change the venue. You can do it mentally. I mean, writing a book was something that I knew very little about, but I got obsessed by it, and I gathered the knowledge. I approached it like I do a big mountain. I got the right people on the bus with me. I came up with a good partner, and we sat down, and we got very, very excited about making the story as good as we could.
Are you saying there is a message in the kind of stuff you've been through, a message for the rest of us?
Yeah, I think that this idea of adventure is, people think about it differently, but I consider it simply embracing the unknown. And I think that that doing that creates flow, which has a way of bringing incredible balance and energy to life. The people who are seeking this flow state are some of the most fulfilled people in the world. And you can do that through rock climbing. You can do that through really anything. You just need to be pushing yourself and become very excited about what it is that you're doing.
Tommy Caldwell's new book is called The Push, A Climber's Journey of Endurance, Risk, and Going Beyond Limits. And you heard that story right here on listener-supported KUOW Seattle. Seattle Seahawks punter John Ryan and his stand-up comedian wife are our guests here in about 5 minutes on listener-supported KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. A Canadian oil pipeline that runs from Alberta to Vancouver might be about to get bigger than either Dakota Access or Keystone XL. Now, if you live in this country, you technically have no say in the matter, but that has not kept Americans from fretting about more tanker traffic in the Strait of Juan de Fuca. And that's why a group of protesters crossed the border last week for a combination march and ferry ride to Vancouver, B.C. EarthFix reporter Eilish O'Neill met up with them as they took off from Friday Harbor in the San Juans.
I really do believe that that's the way that it's supposed to be.
The 10 activists from the San Juan Islands in Port Townsend spent the ferry ride singing songs about the Salish Sea. Cassie Hinburn's a nurse from San Juan Island. She says the point of the four-day march is to raise money for the court cases challenging the pipeline expansion that have been launched by Canada's Native peoples.
We're trying to raise funds for the only fight there is to stop this pipeline.
Kinder Morgan owns the pipeline. It wants to triple its capacity to make room for oil to ship to California and Asia. That would mean 350 more tankers in the Salish Sea every year. Sanborn says she's worried about a potential oil spill.
We run the risk of losing that which we really, truly hold very, very dear.
As we're talking, a cargo ship sails by, headed toward the port of Vancouver. All the oil tankers would have to pass through here, the narrow, windy Strait of Juan de Fuca. One of the points they'd have to skirt is the Center for Whale Research on the west side of San Juan Island. That's why, before getting on the ferry, I swung by to meet with Deborah Giles.
We're looking out the window at the town of Victoria. We can see the tallest building sticking up over the ridgeline there.
Giles researches the salmon-eating orcas that make their home in the Salish Sea. There are only 78 of them left, in part because shipping noise makes it harder for them to find food. Giles is worried about the noise from more tankers, and like Sanborn, worried about a potential spill.
Yes, there's this crazy random border, but if oil gets spilled in Canada, it's not going to end at that imaginary border. It makes me shudder to think how devastated this ecosystem would be.
Kinder Morgan already has the Canadian government's approval and plans to break ground in September. So I headed to the Westridge Marine Terminal, east of Vancouver, to see where all this oil would get loaded onto tankers. I made my way through gates and around massive fuel and oil tanks to meet with Mike Davis, the company's director of marine affairs.
The pipeline is actually coming down through the trees on the other side of the tank there.
Davis points out that even if the expansion goes through, less than half the tankers in the Salish Sea would be headed to Westridge.
It's the Honda Civic of marine loading facilities. This is a very small facility.
Canada's oil sands are the third largest petroleum reserves in the world, but Canada only exports oil to one other country, the U.S. This pipeline would change that.
It's just good for Canada to be able to reach other markets.
Davis says Kinder Morgan has put more than $100 million into beefing up Canada's oil response infrastructure. And anyway, the risk of an oil spill is exaggerated.
We've never had a release from a tanker loading.
But the marchers in Vancouver beg to differ. I caught up with them for the second time as they took a lunch break at South Vancouver's Gordon Park. They were tanned from 3 days of walking and spent their time napping under the trees and taping their blisters. Gordon August, the Seashelt Nation's chief, was leading the march.
Our lands will be affected by the pipelines. our waterways, our fishing. We don't have other ways of means of living.
After a circle and a song, the protesters line up two by two and start up again to the beat of the drum. On the final day of the march, the protesters walked all the way to the gates of the Westridge Terminal. That's where I caught up with Kai Sanborn, the activist from San Juan Island, to ask her how the march had gone.
You know, one of the things that has been really moving is the kind of welcome that we've had from the indigenous representatives. We are one world, we are one people. This is one ocean. We're all in this together.
Kinder Morgan has the money it needs to build the pipeline, but the lawsuits are still making their way through Canada's courts, and the participants in today's march say they're ready to put their bodies in the pipeline's path, if it comes to that. In British Columbia, I'm Alicia Neal.
It's KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. What is up with the Seahawks? An ESPN story about an offense-defense rift, sore feelings going back to the Super Bowl loss, rumors of a divide between Team Russell Wilson and Team Richard Sherman. I had a chance to ask about all of this yesterday when I talked with actress and comedian Sarah Colonna. She's a writer and regular on TV's Chelsea Lately. She'll be at Seattle's Triple Door Theater for two shows on Friday, June 16th, along with a special guest, her husband, Seahawks punter John Ryan. You're going to be on stage together, sort of together. You're not an act.
No.
Okay.
Not
how's
yet.
How's it going to go on stage?
I'm headlining, which is what I normally do. And then we decided it might be fun, since it's in Seattle, to have John host it, which he was given kind of an option. Like, he could either host it or we could do like a Q&A after, just something for, you know, Seattle fans to get to see John. And he decided he wanted to host it.
Yeah, we'll see how that goes. In 2 weeks, I might wish that I opted for the Q&A, but we'll see.
I feel like people always ask me, though, like when John tweets or whatever, people always ask me if I wrote it or if I had something to do with it.
Well, you are just a football player.
I am.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, I got to ask you, John Ryan, I know you're the punter. You're kind of in the middle of this, but I keep hearing about how the Seahawks offensive players and the defensive play, like the Richard Sherman and the defense, think that Russell Wilson and the offense are kind of held to a lower standard. Mm-hmm. What's going on with the Seahawks?
This is all written from a story from one individual who, you know, came out to Seattle a couple times. So there's not, you know, the players, we've barely even talked about it because it's not an issue. You know, these are things that happened years ago, in my opinion, and, you know, certain reporters want to bring them back up again. But it's really, I compare it to if, you know, you went in and sat in someone's house for 5 years or something, and, you know, you took all the stories from those whole 5 years and mashed them all up into one story and acted like they were, you know, a completely dysfunctional family. And that's kind of what this guy did, was just mash together a bunch of stories over a bunch of years and make it look like it all happened overnight.
If there were an offense-defense beef, which side would you be on? Who are you?
Switzerland.
Switzerland, yeah.
Yeah.
I argued about this. Technically, I think the punter would be on the offense because it's still fourth down. You could fake it.
Well, it's funny because punting is a weird position because the play starts an offensive play and it ends as a defensive play. You know,
That's true. We're
protecting a kicking, and then after you kick, you become a tackler. So it's an interesting play because you kind of start as an offensive play and ends as a defensive play.
What is that like for you, that the focus the whole game is to not give the ball away? You're the guy who has to come in after failure and give the ball away. Like, the crowd would hope to never see you the entire game.
Exactly.
Seahawks crowd.
But you know what? I've been doing it for so long. You know, this is my 14th year of professional football. I've done it since I was 7 years old, and I'm 35 now. So I don't really think about it like that. You know, I have a job to do, and, you know, obviously when I'm out there, the fans aren't going crazy. You know, they're usually going to get beer or something.
They're expecting you to run a fake or something.
That's true. But, I have a job to do, and that's just how I approach it, just professionally.
I'm talking with John Ryan, the punter on the Seattle Seahawks. So Seattle is baked into his job, but his wife, actress and comedian Sarah Colonna, you don't even live in Seattle. What do you have against Seattle?
I know. What's my problem?
Yeah.
Well, I definitely am. I love it here. I love it here, but I definitely am a California person. As long as I've lived there now, I just really, really enjoy it. But also because of my work and... you know, I'm there for auditions. I just, I was there. I just booked my first like series regular on a pilot because I was in town for pilot season. So there's like certain things you have to kind of make sure. But I do have the freedom for sure to come here a lot more often. Like I'm going to be here this week, and then just if nothing comes up, I can stay. And if something comes up, I have to go back. And
okay, so then Sarah's off the hook. John,
I do really like Seattle.
But why did you just sign a 4-year deal? Or I don't know how far. You're not very far into a 4-year deal with the Seahawks. Yeah, why don't you play for the L.A. Rams with your sweetie?
Oh, come on, that sounds terrible. Because I like Seattle more than my wife, I guess.
You flinched when I said L.A. Rams. Do you really? I had the impression that you don't care that much, like who's the rival or where you're playing.
No, I think I always say that rivalries are for high school and college teams. You know, where it's like our school versus yours. Where in football, you know, you're playing individuals, you're playing people, you're playing coaches, you're playing schemes. You're not playing cities. You know, so it's a little bit more for fans. But at the same time, you know, when you play a team twice a year for the last decade, like we do the Rams or the 49ers or the Cardinals, then you begin to hate them.
Do you hate the 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick, who apparently almost came to the Seahawks, maybe?
I think he's a very good quarterback. I think
I get the hatred coming from that.
I have a lot of respect for him as a quarterback. I think he's very good.
Okay, that's all you got to say about Colin Kaepernick.
Yeah.
Okay.
And also, another reason for the Rams, too, that you don't want is like they already have a really good punter, right? He's like your buddy.
Exceptionally good punter. Yeah.
But that's not John Ryan good.
No, just right under. Johnny Hecker good. It's Johnny Hecker, right?
He's better.
What's it like to say that? Because I realize from your childhood, you have been the king of your sport for almost your whole life. What is it like to have somebody better than you?
It hurts. But at the same time, I kind of accept it now. I accept it a little bit that, you know, I'm getting older and it's getting harder to keep up to these guys. But at the same time, in the back of my head, I think I can still outpunt all of them on a good day and hopefully have about 16 good days this season.
Is it just leg strength? Or like, what is the key to being an excellent punter?
It's a lot more than that. It's really a full body thing, which people might not realize.
You're huge, by the way. Your arms and shoulders.
Calm down.
And
yeah.
I'm 6 feet tall, so I'm one of the shorter punters in the NFL. A lot of them are, you know, 6'4", 6'5", so they can use their leg strength a little bit more, where I kind of always taken more pride in kind of making myself stronger because I need my whole body to kind of go into the punch. I can't just swing my leg in. I need a little bit more power behind it. So it's more, you know, core and everything kind of comes together to go into a good punt.
Okay. My dad raised me on, do you know who Ray Guy
absolutely,
is?
Absolutely.
Like, my dad was the biggest, Ray Guy was this punter who he would say, watch this, Billy.
Yeah, he you evolutionized know, the position.
Revolution, in the early 70s, I guess it would have been. And he would say, it's all about that he can, Ray Guy, the way he punts the ball, the way he positions it, the way he can, you know, nail the other team down to the goal line, he can change everything. And so I grew up, to me, seriously, like a punter has always been a big deal because my dad pointed it out to me.
Yeah, and I think as time goes on, punters become more important in the NFL just as games become closer. You know, there's not the big difference between the best and the worst teams right now. You know, there's a very small margin of error that you have, and the margin of win every Sunday is, you know, pretty tight. You know, it's usually between 3 and 7 points, 90% of the game. So field position is one of the most important part of the game. So to have a good punter, a good punt unit, and good kickers and good returners, that has really become a huge part of the game, and that's where kind of punting's kind of gone to the next level now.
Think I need to calm down a little, Sarah? I know. Are you feeling threatened?
Yeah, just a little bit. Just a little bit. I mean, you're taller than me, you know?
Right.
Wait, was Ray Guy the one that's in the Hall of Fame,
Hall of Fame,
right?
the only pure punter in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah. Okay.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, he just was inducted 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
I got to ask you about the locker room, because if people keep talking about the locker room, what if Colin Kaepernick came? How would that affect the locker room? How's Richard Sherman affecting the locker room? What's the big deal about the locker room? What actually happens in the locker room? Are you talking politics?
Like 1/10 of what the people from the outside think goes on in the locker room. I mean, there's not that much going on. You know, I think people always want to say, a guy's a problem in the locker room, or, you know, in my whole career, I have seen very few guys where I'd be like, that guy's a problem in the locker room. You know, it's not even really an issue. Hardly, you know, for a group of guys as large as us with as many alpha males as we have in a room like that size, there's actually very few fights. You know, when you think you just put together a group of testosterone-driven guys in their early 20s, you know, even if they're whatever working on a male line, there's going to be fights, you know. But really, when there's this much going on, there's actually very few in fighting.
I think my favorite thing that's ever been, like, after that, remember the whole Trump and locker room talk and all that thing that came out John was like, I don't know what he thinks that we talk about, but he was like, it was like right after that, he was like, Jermaine and I talked about the Bachelorette all, you know, afternoon yeah. one day in the locker room. So right. I,
yeah. yeah, weren't you tweeting, John? That's not locker room banter that I've yeah. ever heard.
No, I mean, I'm sure there's conversations that go on in the locker room that are probably, you know, sexually oriented or in a sexual nature. But those are actually, you know, few and far between. You know, I mean, the talk of a locker room is probably not that much different than the talk in a normal office, to be honest.
Except you're naked.
Except for we're naked all the time. Actually, all that's
wait, you
rule.
Guys don't do that here? That's weird.
Sometimes.
Naked Friday.
Naked Friday. Yeah. Yeah. It keeps you in shape when you know Naked Friday is coming.
Yeah. A lot of pressure.
Yeah. Sarah Colonna is the headliner at Seattle's Triple Door Friday, June 16th. Two shows.
Yes.
And the MC is who again?
Johnny Hecker? No, John Ryan.
Oh, that's another punter.
John Ryan.
That is a different punter, and that's brutal. John Ryan, Seahawks punter, you're on stage too. Good to meet both of you.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for having us.
All right. We'll wait and see. Now, you heard us mention Colin Kaepernick there, right? I asked about the San Francisco's quarterback. For a second, it seemed like America's most outspoken quarterback and Pete Carroll's free-to-be-you-and-me Seahawks were actually going to join forces. But then this week, the Seahawks signed a backup quarterback named Austin Davis, not Colin Kaepernick. Why did that not work out? Was it money? Well, Kaepernick retweeted a news report that said he and the Seahawks weren't very far apart on money. Was Kaepernick the wrong guy? Here's Seahawks coach Pete Carroll saying Kaepernick is basically too good to be a backup.
He's a starter in this league, you know, you know, I can't imagine that we have a starter, you know, but he's a starter in this league, and I can't imagine that somebody won't give him a chance to play.
Well, then, Pete, if he's a starter in this league, why isn't he starting for something?
That's not my issue. I know. We brought him in here to check him out, and we know what we're doing with him. And I think it was really very productive for us to get to know him better. I've never really sat down to that.
Do you think his stance last year has impacted his ability to get employment?
I don't know that. Let's wait and see.
Let's wait and see if Colin Kaepernick makes it to an NFL roster. Pete Carroll says he should be a starter, just not in Seattle. It's KUOW's The Record.